Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Stars at night are big and bright.
Yeah, yeah.
Deep in the heart of Texas.
Thank you, Bob Wills. And I'm joined now by Gail Collins. Yes, the New York Times columnist noticed that some of the most important prominent ideas and players in national politics had a Texas twang, and she headed there to find out what that was all about. Her new book is As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. Hey, Gail, welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, it's good to be here.
So in the prologue, you say the moment when Governor Perry seemed to entertain thoughts of secession over the Obama stimulus package is when you decided you needed to take a closer look at Texas. New York City's perennial threat to secede from the state is different.
I think that's different. Leaving your state is one thing. Leaving your country is another. But what so interested me about it when I started to think about it was this is a state that's basically set the national agenda for the last 30 years, and they're really ticked off about the federal government. What does that mean for the rest of us?
And let's see, didn't anti-war activists want Vermont to succeed over the Iraq war? So maybe there's something about former republics, which Texas and Vermont both were, turned states.
You know, it's so funny. When I was in Texas one time, I went on a tour of the state capitol, and they have the Texas flag kind of, you know, in the floor there, in the tile. And I was looking at it and thinking, wow, you know, the Texas Independent Republic, which was like for about 9 years, gets the big center of the flag and the little tiny flags around it for France, which it was part of for about 4 minutes, are all around. And the United States flag is in there in the little tiny circle around the edge. And the guide was saying, yeah, we were a republic. We were our own republic. Well, Vermont was a republic for like 2 minutes once, but that wasn't the same at all. And actually, Vermont was a republic for much longer than Texas, but somehow it didn't stick in the same way.
Interesting. Maybe I should point out that what sealed the deal for you doing this book was the headline about murder using a frozen armadillo.
Yeah, as I was thinking about Texas and talking with people about Texas, a friend of mine sent me this headline that said, "Man allegedly beats woman with frozen armadillo." And I thought, this is a place I need to know more about.
And maybe we'll come back to why animals figure so prominently in your political columns. But seriously, which ideas are you attributing to Texas specifically if you say they've had this outsized influence on American policy?
Yeah, if you look back to the 80s, the savings and our first savings and loan crisis happened because the Reagan administration decided to base its new federal regulations of savings and loan on the Texas model, because Texas's savings and loans were so profitable. They had not yet figured out that was because the Texas savings and loans were cooking their books, but that was the beginning of sort of the great crisis there. And then the deregulation of banks, which led to all of our interesting crises in 2008, and the deregulation of the financial markets. There were a billion people involved, including many Democrats, but I think Senator Phil Graham of Texas was probably, if you picked one guy with his hand in every single pot, it might well be Phil Graham. And then, of course, No Child Left Behind, our massive federal plan on education and public school education is based on the Texas model that George W. Bush brought with him when he became president. And then, of course, you've got energy and you've got the environment. I thought it was great that George W. Bush, when he ran, the party platform said that they promised that the nominee would do as much for the environment nationally as he had done for the environment in Texas. And Texas at the time had the most polluted air, the most polluted water, the most polluted everything in the entire country. So I guess he did kind of keep his promise.
Well,
and then there were land wars, all the land wars under Texas presidents, in my lifetime anyway.
We lost that last word. The land wars in your lifetime, and then what?
All of them under Texas presidents. There's just been a bunch.
Including LBJ. So it's bipartisan.
Totally bipartisan. It's just the Alamo, I think. It's the whole remember the Alamo idea.
Listeners, anybody from Texas out there want to call in and talk to Gail Collins about her take on Texas? this New Yorker's take on the Lone Star State and its influence on national politics today and policy. 212-433-WNYC. Any expat Texans around here or people living in Texas and listening there right now? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Gail Collins' new book, As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. And as I understand it, Texas has a couple of things going on. It's the leader of the empty space school of thought, and you mentioned the Alamo. How do you think seriously the Alamo sets the stage for what you call Texas's unique blend of egomania and paranoia?
There is it's something going on there. There really is. It's everybody. I think almost every public school student in Texas goes to the Alamo at some point to take a pilgrimage, and you know reads the Travis letter about the you know victory or death. And when I went to the Alamo, I looked at it. My reaction was, wow, these guys were very heroic, but what a bad plan this was. They could have gotten out. They could have gone and helped Sam Houston fight, you know, with the rebels. But there's something about taking these grand and glorious stands, possibly totally disastrous, that kind of really captures the Texas imagination.
And to be fair, I guess we should point out that Donald Trump is not a Texan, right?
We have our people. They're just different. I can't imagine Donald Trump at the Alamo. Donald Trump would have, you know, had a deal in 14 seconds.
He would have bought it.
You're
avoided
right.
All that bloodshed. And the empty state idea, even though Texas does have some big cities, you write that the entire world population could fit into Texas if it was as densely packed as New York City. Were you kidding?
No, that's a true fact. And they're not planning on doing that anytime in the near future, but it's big enough. You could put the whole world in Texas if it was as dense as New York City is.
And having all that space, or the idea that there's all that space somewhere, even if you're caught in the sprawling suburbs of Austin, it means somehow it translates to concealed firearm rights and low taxes?
I have always thought, when I covered Congress, I always thought that the real political divide was between people who perceived themselves as living in empty places and people who felt they lived in crowded places. If you live in a crowded place, you appreciate government. You know, government is what protects you from burglars. Government is what keeps dogs from pooping on the sidewalk. Government is what keeps sewers from exploding. It does a whole mess of things, and you really appreciate it. If you live in what you perceive to be an empty place, there's almost no point. I mean, if a burglar comes, you're going to have to defend yourself. You don't get in anybody else's way. Nobody gets in your way. It's a completely different view of the way the world operates. The problem for the empty place people is that outside of the U.S. Senate, if you don't have any people, you don't really have any power. And the great power of Texas is that it's very crowded. I mean, the most 80% of the people live in metropolitan areas in Texas, but they all think, they feel like they live in an empty place, in the open spaces, because the place is so big and you do have to drive endlessly to get from, say, one city to another. So they feel like they live in an empty place, even though they don't at all.
James in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Gail Collins.
Hi.
Hello, James.
First of all, on the idea of succession, I think it's a good idea. I think that New York, New England, and the upper Midwest, Minnesota, Wisconsin, we ought to secede and link up with Canada. We have much more in common with them politically in the last 100 years than we do with the South and Texas, of course. And as far as Texas, this Texas envy, isn't it just a function of, you know, New Yorkers resentful of losing out their historical dominance of the American political system with the Roosevelts and all of that? And also, if you want to point to a state that's had really inordinate influence, you would point to Massachusetts, right? I mean, the Kennedys, Mitt Romney, Tsongas, Dukakis. I mean, it just goes on and on. They all think they should be president.
Gail, go ahead.
Massachusetts is the only state that can compete with Texas for the number of terrible presidential candidates that it has produced over the years, I think. But Massachusetts manages to get them nominated, all these terrible candidates. So I guess it goes a little bit farther.
Of course, the outsized influence of Paul Tsongas, I might have missed that. James, thank you very much. Baki in Woodbridge, you're on WNYC. Hello, Baki.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My first 15 years or so in Texas, it really felt like, a history of its own, because first they had Texas history, and then they would have U.S. history. It's almost, Texas is almost a country of itself. It's got its own oil producing power. It's got its own international border. And just the size of itself, and also the dialogue, whether it's language draw. If you ever have a southern draw, they always ask you, where are you from? Texas. Not Mississippi, Louisiana, or anything else.
Thank you.
That's
very
a really good point. You know, Texans have a sense of self-identity as Texans, but I think it's really unique. I mean, I come from Ohio, and I like Ohio a lot, but I can never remember studying Ohio history or saluting the Ohio flag. The Texas school children salute the Texas flag, and I wouldn't have known the Ohio state song if you, sang it to me. And I certainly would never have worn a T-shirt saying, don't mess with Ohio. It's a very special place in that way. Texans think of themselves very much as Texans, and they do it. It's really drilled into their kids. And somebody sent me a note on Memorial Day saying, well, and now that I've read your book, I think maybe it was unusual that we would give each other Texas state flags on Memorial Day, but that's what we did.
Wow. Joe in Harlem, you're on WNYC with Gail Collins. Hi, Joe. Joe, you there?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I would like to ask Gail how much she thinks race plays into the various policies of the Lone Star State.
Well, Texas likes the South in general. Texas, like the South in general, you know, used to be Democratic, and then after the Civil Rights Law was passed, started moving over to the Republican side. If you were really unflattering, you could basically say the Texas politics majority white vote has always been wherever the African Americans aren't. When the Civil War was fought, after that, everybody became a Democrat, and then after the Civil Rights Movement, they all became Republicans. Texas is now a majority-minority state, although most of the minority is Hispanic. There's a large African-American population. And the old history on race in Texas was just as bad as it has been in any southern state.
But we mentioned Texas, one of its uniquenesses being that it has its own international border. And if Texas leads the nation on all these different policies that George W. Bush and others brought us, No Child Left Behind, banking reform, whatever— he also tried to lead the nation in comprehensive immigration reform. And, of course, they've got such a big Mexican population there sharing that huge border, Mexican immigrant population, that you see why that could become a political imperative even of Texas Republicans. But that one hasn't broken out. But do you think they're kind of getting it right somehow in Texas with respect to immigration in a less fraught way than Arizona, which we hear about all the time?
Yeah, I would say to Texas's credit that they're much more comfortable with their identity as a state that's got a large Hispanic population that used to be part of Mexico. The immigration craziness is not nearly as intense in Texas as you might find it in, say, Arizona. And you could sort of see that in the Republican debates when Mitt Romney turned on Rick Perry about amnesty and about, you know, supporting the DREAM Act and giving special consideration to children who were illegal themselves. You could sort of see that he was kind of stunned because the idea of giving children whose parents brought them there when they were young illegally access to the state colleges was something that was supported by everybody in Texas. It was a huge business initiative. It was bipartisan in the legislature. So they're not as crazy on that subject as I would say other people are down there.
Marcus in Larchmont, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, how are you doing today?
All right. How about you?
I don't know where I would actually begin, and granted, I have not heard everything that the speaker's been discussing. I've kind of been in and out of the conversation and the discourse here, but I am an expat. You had made a request for expats to to chime in to the dialogue here, and I've lived in New York on and off for close to 17 years. But I will say, like any place, and mind you, I will say that I'm a PhD. I have a PhD in sociology, and I do teach cultural sociology at a local university. That to make the very gross generalizations about an entire state as a kind of cultural monolith is pretty problematic, I would, to put it politely, and to ignore how Texas has grown substantially. And the caller did discuss the significant amount of immigration from Mexico and Central America, but there's also been a tremendous amount of immigration from other states. Houston, where I'm from, has grown by 4 or 5 million in the last 30 or 40 years, and largely due to internal immigration from the Midwest, from the Northeast, from the West, et cetera.
Affecting it how, Marcus?
I'm sorry?
Affecting it how?
Affecting it politically. I mean, let's talk about George Bush and the Bush family, who are local residents here to Largemont and Rye and to Massachusetts and everything else, who are quintessential blue bloods from the Northeast. Many other influential politicians mm-hmm. have largely been born and raised elsewhere and have immigrated to Texas. So,
right, like George H.W. Bush was from Connecticut and moved to Texas, and George W. Bush was raised there. So, Gail, you're criticized for overgeneralizing.
Yeah, that's a problem whenever you talk about almost anything, you tend to generalize. But it's certainly true that the population growth of Texas has been amazing, and there are a lot of people have come in. I mean, Senator Phil Graham, who's one of my favorite crazy people of Texas, came from elsewhere, I believe. And I know that I think Dick Armey came from Colorado or somewhere else. There's a lot of immigration in, and many of those people, like the Bushes, become, you know, very, very, especially George W., totally identified with Texas. I don't think the fact that you were not born in Texas makes you not a Texan if you come there and adopt it as your state.
But are you saying that despite these various kinds of diversity in Texas, that the political culture is dominated by a certain kind of white Republican populism that traces its roots to, you know, open spaces and the Alamo and that kind of identity?
Yeah, it's totally an empty spaces kind of vision, and that, and the Alamo, and the sense of we were once our own independent republic. All of that stuff is really important.
Gail, your dog definitely does not like this discussion of Texas. Marcus, is there anything you want to say?
I was not on the roof. Can I tell you that?
I'd like to see the empiricisms there to support that accusation. Because I don't recall ever going to the Alamo. However, I do recall going to see The Last Temptation of Christ. So, you know, once again, you know, I'm here to problematize, I think, some really gross mm-hmm. generalization. As, you know, we could certainly dive into the depths, the nefarious depths of New York politics and the racism and prejudice that still is very much alive in New York.
Marcus, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. We'll continue in a minute with New York Times columnist Gail Collins. Her new book is called As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. And when we continue, we'll also get into some of Gail's recent columns, maybe including the influence of shrimp on her opinion of John Edwards and the influence of deer ticks on the J.P. Morgan Chase debacle, maybe the influence of her dog on this conversation. Stay with us. Gail Collins, the New York Times columnist, with her new book, As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. And, Gail, before we get to some of your writings in the Times, we have so many Texas questions coming in that let's run through some of these for you, okay? Josh in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you guys could address the issue of why does Texas execute more people than anyone else?
That's an excellent question. That's part of their law and order thing, and it really is kind of, I think, part of the empty places thing too. You don't, you know, have much mercy on people who mess around with you if you have to defend yourself in an empty place. That's the best spin I could possibly put on it. Texas has record lots of things, and executing prisoners is definitely one of them.
There was that sign at one of the Occupy demonstrations that said, "I'll know a corporation is a person when Texas executes one." Jim in Brick, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Texas is so big, like Alaska. There's a lot of reliance on air travel, but also it's a mecca for Air Force retirees. And I just wondered if and one of them who writes for Texas Monthly is Sarah Bird, but she's sort of like a latter-day Molly Ivins. But I was calling the comment about the overdue determinant of Texas on the educational agenda with the public schools book selection throughout the rest of the country.
Right. I've heard this too. Gail, did you confirm this in your research that a lot of the national textbooks are written to Texas standards because it's such a big market, which includes things like Dancing Around Evolution and things like that?
Yeah, there was a very long period in which the Texas has a state board of education that's elected. And in elections, Texas always has bad turnout, but the turnout for state board of education elections, as you can imagine, is really low. And it's dominated by people who really, really, really care, which tended to be the right wing for a long time. So you manage to hit people on the state board. One of the women on the board believed that public schools were the tool of the devil, and she was on the state board of education. So it was quite a group. And they had a system in which the state board picked four possible textbooks for each subject, for each grade, and then paid for the books for any school that picked one of those four. So all in all, it became this massive market in which everybody was desperate to please Texas. And the state board had a lot of really interesting ideas about what you should put in a textbook if a Texas child was going to read it. The upshot of it all, and it's not as bad now, I have to say, they've really kind of curbed it in, but the upshot of it all, I think, was not so much that they made the textbooks, which every other part of the country tended to buy, too, because the bulk prices were lower. It didn't make them wrong so much as it made them impossible to read because the publishers were skirting around so many different issues that they thought the Texas board might not like. That right now, I mean, some of these books are humongous and they're full of boxes that people throw in to make them somebody happy somewhere along the line, and they're almost unreadable.
Rachel in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Gail. How are y'all?
Okay.
Hi.
Oh, y'all.
You can't get rid of it when you grow up.
There's a clue where you're from, huh?
No, I wanted to sort of comment on the identity piece. I think that's really interesting. I talk about this with my parents all the time, but there's this really interesting vestigial cowboy mythology that whether you want to lay claim to it just sort of pervades the entire culture there. And I think the reason Texans are so influential in politics is because we demand it. There's this, you know, sort of aggressive sort of machismo kind of attitude down there that people really take a hold of and take some degree of pride in.
And I think you're absolutely right.
What about women?
Oh, you know, women, we're sassy. We'll do it too. I mean, you know, people like Molly Ivins, you know. I mean, my goodness, I think you know, women will be aggressive too, but it's in a different way. You know, there's definitely an attitude there.
Rachel, thanks a lot.
Sure.
And
sure.
Rachel's the second to mention the late liberal columnist Molly Ivins. And Sheldon from Brooklyn on our comments page says he wants to point out that Texas does have things like South by Southwest every year. They have their fair share of hipsters as well, he says. So Molly Ivins, Ann Richards, South by Southwest. There's also this progressive strain of Texan.
Oh, absolutely. Lyndon Johnson. I mean, my Lord, Lyndon Johnson produced more liberal domestic policy than anybody since Franklin Roosevelt, and he was a product of that populist strain in Texas. And when Johnson was around, he managed to work out a system by which he got tons and tons and tons of contracts for all the businesses that were in Texas, and he got tons and tons of money from the businesses, and he used those to create a Democratic Party that was really strong for a long time, but the combination of the movement of the conservatives to the Republican Party, the death of Lyndon Johnson, the changes nationally that have happened, it's just decimated the Democratic Party. And they haven't won a statewide election since 1994. And that means they're 0 for 99, basically. It's just really a wreck right now. And all of the Democrats, if you talk to them down there, keep saying, yeah, but the Latino vote, we're going to be a majority Hispanic state soon. And the Latino vote is a Democratic vote, so that's when we're going to really turn around. The problem is that Texans in general have a very bad voting turnout record. And Hispanic Texans are even worse than Anglo Texans are on that front. So it's going to have to be a real huge change in the way that people vote in the state before the Republicans lose their control.
So Zuska from Yonkers writes on our page, "Don't mess with Texas," the slogan, is actually the highly successful slogan of a mid-80s anti-highway littering campaign created by the State Department of Transportation. So in case you wondered where that bit of what she says, don't characterize it as Texas truculence, came from, it, of all things, an anti-highway littering campaign. Don't mess with Texas.
You know, I did not know that. That is fascinating. But I have to say right now, it's become a pretty truculent part of the culture. Can I say one thing, too, about the women of Texas?
Yeah.
The sagas of the women of Texas are just, some of them, absolutely incredible. They were very fierce always and very more practical, I think, than the men, and much more inclined to, you know, not go the crazy route, at least at points along the way. My very favorite is this woman named Angelina Eberly, who's got a big statue now in Austin. She was an innkeeper during the period in which the Texans were fighting about where the capital was, and right after the Civil War, and that she was before the Civil War. I'm sorry, and she was in her little inn one night and discovered that Sam Houston had sent somebody to take the state archives out of Austin and take them over to Houston, where he wanted the capital to be. And she ran out and fired a cannon and rallied the people of Austin to get their archives back. And there is this violent statue of this fierce lady with her cannon, you know, waving her arm, which is a very kind of Texas vision, I think, of what the women of Texas are like.
And an interesting vision of the Second Amendment, the right to bear cannons. Gail Collins, New York Times columnist, my guest on WNYC. Her new book is called As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. One more Texas call, then we're going to get into some of your columns briefly. Fiona in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I really had to comment because I'm a very, very proud Texan. Lived in Houston for 11 and a half years. Oftentimes people ask me why I like Texas, and I say because it's hot and cheap. I moved to Manhattan 5 months ago, and I've just been really taken aback about people's perception of Houston and Texas, because my experience has been one of diversity. Houston has a lesbian mayor, and I soon realized that because we had Rick Perry run for president, unfortunately, the prevailing stereotypes have just persisted. So I just wanted to share my voice with you and stand up for Texans and just say it's a great state, and I loved my life there and consider it a homeland.
Were you brought up in the London district of Texas?
Yeah. Similar to that. I know my Texas drawl kind of gets in the way sometimes.
Originally UK and you moved to Texas.
Exactly. Originally UK. Born and bred in the UK and moved to Texas in the year 2000. It's been an amazing life for me, and I miss it very much.
Thank you very much. Gail, a word to Fiona?
Well, Houston is a very Democratic city. The mayor right now is indeed gay. The vast majority of Houston residents under the age of 30 are minorities. The vast majority of older people in Houston are Anglo. It's not represented in its politics of the state in general. But I would like to say, in defense of Texans and particularly Houston, that after Hurricane Katrina, Houston took in 200,000 refugees and did it gladly.
Right.
And I'm not sure even in Manhattan or New York we would be willing to go that far. So I say hats off to Houston.
All right. Let me touch on a few things from your recent columns. One is the influence of shrimp on your opinion of John Edwards. And it seems like you were never one of those progressives especially smitten with his populist charm.
No, but I always wanted to be. I always, you know, like I think a lot of people thought, wow, you know, if John Edwards were the Democratic nominee, he's from the South, he's, you know, really cute, he's he talks about poor people all the time, he's got all these position papers, wow, what a great nominee in theory. But every time I ran up against him, it was really, really, really disappointing. He just seemed like an incredibly shallow guy.
What was the shrimp conversation?
I was down in, when he was running for president the last time, very early on, he was down in South Carolina and had came out in this press conference in favor of a move by the local shrimpers to ban Vietnamese imported shrimp into the United States. And we were riding back together to the airport, and I said, but, you know, all your voters who go to Red Lobster, are they going to want to pay the price for all American shrimp? It'd be like way more expensive. And he kind of waved me away. And then I said, and you know, we encourage the Vietnamese to develop capitalistic small enterprises that are labor intensive. And, you know, what about trade? And he finally turned to me and said, you care a lot about shrimp, don't you? And just sort of dismissed me on it. Well, yeah, I'm wrong here. We're not going to do issues
yeah,
today.
Yeah, why actually get into the weeds of policy when you're running for president? And you wrote up the influence, or shall we say the excuse, of deer ticks on the J.P. Morgan multi-billion dollar loss.
Yeah, I didn't know that till we had the story in our paper that one of the top executives of Morgan, who was in charge to a great extent of, you know, sort of overseeing risk factors, was out of commission during this period of, you know, traders gone wild because she had Lyme disease. And she was from New Jersey, and she gardened a lot. And, you know, and just ticks in general are just incredibly proliferating, and you don't think about them, and then suddenly are all over the place, just in your face. And it kind of reminded me of Donald Trump. You know?
And then the only person who could possibly have prevented these stupid trading decisions was out sick from the ticks, and so they lost $3 billion.
Yes, it's all the ticks' fault. We got to blame somebody. So I say blame the ticks, blame the deer that carry the ticks.
And you had an online exchange with David Brooks on a more serious note, in which you wrote about Obama. Poor guy. He said, when he goes all positive and hopey, his base demands to know why he won't get in there and fight. Then when he fights, critics like David say he's abandoned his positive message. Is the hopey Obama gone for this election?
No, I don't think necessarily. It's interesting to me, wherever I go right now, people get up, you know, and they're clearly Democrats, and say, oh, my God, what's going on? You know, this is so terrible. Why can't he get his act together? We're doomed. This is, you know, he's got no message. He's not really telling his story. And they're just so miserable and frightened. And it's only June. I think it's going to, this exactly same thing happened 4 years ago. You went through this period in the summer where everybody said, oh, my God, he's not that good. He's not nearly as good as we thought. It's going to be terrible. They were suicidal, and then, you know, he picked up again. So I'm not sure that we want to really take whatever is happening this week as an arbiter of how well he's going to run his campaign.
He's certainly not running on what he's going to do in his second term, don't you think?
Right. Well, I think that's sort of natural right now. That, you know, the big question right now is, you know, our economy is not where we think it should be. Why didn't he do better, and would Mitt Romney do a better job? And that's probably going to be the argument all the way through.
Any thoughts about the lessons of Wisconsin yesterday?
Yeah, actually, David and I just finished conversing about that. It's, to me, really sad. I mean, David takes hope in the fact that he thinks it's like a strong signal that people really do want to control, you know, middle-class entitlements before they get completely out of hand. But just to me, it was once again the Republicans saying, you know, we can solve all of our problems by cutting back on stuff that the non-rich people get, and particularly things that involve groups that support the Democratic Party. We can really undo them completely, if at all possible. And labor, you know, labor certainly has its flaws, but is a counterbalance to what goes on to counterbalance to corporate influence. I think it's critical, and this is a desperate, terrible blow for labor. So I'm very depressed today.
Do you think there might be any backlash to Romney from this Florida campaign official of his who tweeted out in response to the results, "Pack it in, unions, it's over." Did you see that yet?
No, you know, I'm not into the degree to which we can blame candidates for all the stuff that their, you know, surrogates do. I think, you know, it's sort of minimal, but it is true. There's no secret within the Republican Party that this is the whole point of this is to disable the unions because they've been a huge supporter of, it's exactly the same as the trial lawyers, you know, to go back to Texas for 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Texas has eviscerated everything that trial lawyers like or need. If you're a worker and you have a compensation claim, you can no longer, the trial lawyers can no longer represent you because there's just no money in it whatsoever. You just don't get anything. There is no legal procedure anymore. There's a 9 billion things like that. And allegedly it's because, you know, business people don't like trial lawyers. But it's really because the Republican Party doesn't like trial lawyers because they give all their money to Democrats. And it's the same thing with the public employee unions. It's true that in many ways that, you know, they've got the benefits need to be controlled. But the big message for the Republicans is these are guys who support the Democrats. Let's go get them and knock them out.
And when David says it's a blow to all middle class entitlements, he means much more than just the steep increase in pension and health benefits for public employees.
Yeah, well, David, and I don't like to speak today because he speaks so well for himself, but David is, you know, very, very concerned about the growth of Social Security, the growth of Medicare, the incredible costs of all of these benefits that go to often middle-class retirees, and he really feels that we're going to just lose our way as a country unless we get the debt under control and get these entitlements under control. We have thought about this on many occasions, actually.
And listeners, you can read Gail Collins and David Brooks' exchange on Wisconsin on nytimes.com. You can read Gail in the New York Times on the op-ed page, and read her in her new book, As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. Gail, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, public radio producer Charlie Schroeder talks about the year he spent reenacting one battle after another. You know those war reenactments that people do? Well, he took a year. He went from ancient Rome to Stalingrad. We'll ask him if he did the Alamo. Maybe he did the Scott Walker recall election. Who knows? Stay with us.